The Behind the Bets podcast with Doug Kazarian is presented by DraftKings. Download the app for free today.
Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you. This is Behind the Bets.
Welcome into another Behind the Bets podcast. We are taping this on a Wednesday, June 24th. So a day earlier than we normally do. We're going to get into the UFC with Matthew Holt like we usually do, but we're also going to talk a little golf. So whether it be daily fantasy or just your regular sportsbook betting, we want to get you some picks coming up later in the show. Wes Reynolds, friend of the program, will join me. He knows his golf inside and out. So we're going to talk about each of our plays for the weekend. Christina, another exciting golf tournament last week and also a good UFC card.
Yeah, I'm excited for this upcoming weekend. I'm glad that sports at least are somewhat regularly back. So it should be exciting.
I agree. The soccer's been plentiful as well. So I know a lot of you diehards for the pitch are welcoming the EPL back and then all the other leagues as well throughout the world. So look, we're getting there slowly but surely. Had certainly positive news with Major League Baseball, positive meaning in terms of games being played. And then also the NBA and NHL getting closer to that with team sports. And then the NFL and college football, we're going to wait and see. But we're all optimistic and it's time to get excited. But we have a great card. If you want to get this before Thursday's round, you can always kind of listen to the golf first. The time codes are there. So go check out that before the tournament begins in the Hartford area. So right in our backyard here. But first, we're going to get to Matthew Holt with some UFC. But I also want to remind everyone that my ESPN colleague, Scott Van Pelt, also has a podcast called SB Pod. Make sure you download and subscribe to Behind the Bets and SB Pod on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
We now bring in a friend of the program, a regular here on the Behind the Bets podcast, Matthew Holt. How are you, my good friend?
Doing great. You know, got to get away from the Vegas heat last weekend, went up to Northern Nevada, did a little fly fishing. Fortunately, the hotel had ESPN, so I didn't miss the fights, but, you know, good card last week. I thought we had some nice positive results and I'm excited about this card too. The main event's great and it's grabbing all the headlines here, but I think there's some really good betting opportunities and betting angles in particular on this card.
Well, yeah, I definitely want to pull a muscle patting ourselves on the back, but I will say it was very well done on like our favorite plays. Obviously I was pushing your quote when you said, I have not seen a play I like as much as this in a while. And that was Pennington. And she lost the first round on a couple judges scorecards, but she dominated the next two and clearly was much better. And, as you predicted, that fight unfolded and well done with Guida. You said it. He had the chin. He was going to go the distance. And with Miller, you were saying that he had a legit chance with his submission. Obviously, it was the armbar that got it done. So you thought the under 2.5 was strong just because you didn't think Miller could go the distance. So those are your three top plays. I thought you hit it out of the park there.
Well, I appreciate it. And we certainly had a good week. And I like some totals again this week. I think there's some really interesting totals. I think we've learned a lot from the smaller cage and what it means and what type of fights tend to go the distance and what type of fights tend to end quickly in the smaller cage. And stylistically, I think there's some really good matchups this week that fit total plays both over and under. And I think there's some really good sides this week as well.
I agree. I like this card. Not quite as much as last week, but I like it. And let's go from there. So let's start with the main event. You mentioned it. Dan Hooker, Dustin Poirier. This has been bet up a little bit to minus 220. It's a lightweight matchup. Obviously, Poirier, a veteran, 25-6 record. He's the number three contender. Lost his last fight, I believe it was September a year ago, but that's understandable. It was against Khabib. He had won four straight before that. Some pretty big names, guys we've talked about here on this podcast. So he's a great striker, also goes to the ground. But Dan Hooker's no slouch either. He's the number five contender. The price feels right. I guess I would bet Poirier if I had to, but what about you?
I agree with you that the price on the side does feel right. Think of the guys that Dustin Poirier has beat and how well those wins have aged. Justin Gaethje, Max Holloway, Anthony Pettis, Jim Miller, Bobby Green. I mean, he has some really impactful wins over elite guys. I mean, Justin Gaethje, is going to fight for the title in his next fight. And Dustin Poirier just dismantled him when they fought. So at least, if nothing else, you know what you're getting with Poirier. And he's only lost to the very most elite guys in the world, Khabib, Conor McGregor. He did have one fluky loss on his resume to Michael Johnson in a fight where we know Michael Johnson can punch, and he caught him with that big left hand. Dan Hooker is a guy that reminds me of Rafael Dos Anjos. So Rafael Dos Anjos was a middling lightweight for a long time. And then all of a sudden, he went on this big run and went all the way to become the lightweight champion. People forget he was a huge underdog against Anthony Pettis in that title fight. Against Anthony Pettis, rather, in that title fight. And then, of course, he became a favorite against Eddie Alvarez, where he lost the title. But Rafael Dos Anjos was a middling, you know, middle-of-the-road lightweight forever. And Dan Hooker was the same. People forget that it wasn't that long ago Dan Hooker was on a 2-3 run in the UFC. All of a sudden, he's 7-1 since that 2-3 over his last 8 fights, with wins over Gilbert Burns, Paul Felder, James Vick, Jim Miller. And one of the things that I think is important here, because I like the over 2.5 rounds, is Dan Hooker has only been finished once in his last 19 fights. This is a guy whose striking defense isn't the best, but his chin's good. He's durable. You know, he's tough. He stays in the fight. His last two wins have come by decision. So as he's gone on this run, again, he was on a 2-3 run, suddenly steps up in competition. What we have seen is he's not carrying that knockout power necessarily into against elite competition. I actually thought he lost the decision to Paul Felder, but that's another topic for another day. The point is he tends to go the distance now with elite fighters. He tends not to get finished. And if you look at Dustin Poirier, although he has so many finishes on his resume, 5 of his last 7 fights have actually gone to at least round 3. So we're talking about a guy that, while he does get finishes, whether it's via knockout or submission, those finishes tend to come later in fights. And thus, because of that, I think over 2.5 rounds in the -120 range is probably how I'm going to be playing the main event.
Okay. So if you need to get action on the main event, maybe look there. It's not one of your top plays per se, but hey, we all like to bet the big, wrap things up at the end of the night. So 2.5, the over, is what you would take. So I like that. I like that, rationale. Now the card mixes up a little bit, but we're going to go in order of a lot of the, rotation, if you will. So I'm looking at the Caesars app. There's some other places that have a similar rotation. So let's go to Maurice Green against Vyante, in a heavyweight bout. So obviously Vyante, the big hitter, 10 of 17 wins have come via the knockout. Green has lost 2 fights in a row, but he's much bigger here. He's about -215 as well. And that's the only side I would play, I think, on this one.
Yeah, and I had to look up this fight to see if it was going to be fought at heavyweight or light heavyweight. Because if it was going to be fought at light heavyweight, I was thinking, how the heck can Maurice Green ever make light heavyweight? I mean, the guy has to cut weight to make 265. John Vellante here, who's moving up in weight, seeing if he can have some better performances at heavyweight after struggling quite a bit, going 2-4 in his last 6 at light heavyweight. The problem is he was getting knocked out at light heavyweight. This is a guy who was knocked out 5 times at light heavyweight. His striking defense is terrible. And I don't know that his power is going to go up in weight. Maurice Green's not a heavyweight I love. I don't think he's a heavyweight that's ever going to compete for the title. He's a big, huge, giant guy at 6'7". And he certainly does have some punching power, but he only has 2 knockouts and 8 wins. For this big, giant heavyweight who hasn't fought the best level of competition, he doesn't exactly have a ton of knockout wins. He actually has twice as many wins by submission as he does by knockout. And we don't see heavyweights getting fights to the ground a lot because it's really hard. You have to be really athletic as a heavyweight to shoot in on a double leg and be able to get a successful takedown. A lot of the takedowns at heavyweight come via trip or something else. But in this case, if they do get in the clinch and his size difference is so substantial, Vellante may have trouble with it. This was a fight I'm completely staying away from. I don't know anything. I didn't like Vellante as a light heavyweight. While he did have power himself, his defense was atrocious, and he tended to get knocked out quite a bit. So I don't really want to play Vellante here, but I'm not as confident in Maurice Greene as the odds makers are, making him almost a 2.5-to-1 favorite. And thus, I'm probably going to stay away. If I was going to look anywhere, it might have been the under. But even the under price at 2.5 rounds is around -160, -160.
Yeah, higher, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think I can get involved in that at all. This one's a complete stay away and just watch the tube.
Yeah, watch it, maybe play for the next fight. We have another heavyweight bout to break down. Tanner Boser against Philippe Lenz. Lenz about -215 here. Look, he's lost 4 straight before going up to the heavyweight. We know he won the PFL tournament in that class. Has the background with the Brazilian. But Boser has versatility here. I think I jump on the dog, but again, this is another stay away for me. I hope you have an opinion.
I actually like Felipe Lins here. I think he trains at a better gym. I actually think he's more well-rounded than people give him credit for. He does have 4 wins by submission. He trains at a gym with some of the most elite grapplers in the world. And he's just the slightest of favorites here, -115, -120 at a couple of books. But there's also a couple -110s out there as well. And at the end of the day, I always tell this to people, if you made a case for the guy in his last fight, which I did for Felipe Lins versus Andre Arlovsky, then why do you suddenly not like him anymore? What happened in that Arlovsky fight that you don't like Felipe Lins anymore? And for me, it's nothing. All I thought that happened in that fight, and first of all, I thought Felipe Lins won that fight. I had him winning that fight 29-28. The second round of that fight was very, very close. One judge gave Arlovsky the first round. I don't even know how that was possible. Lins dominated that round. But either way, I don't think it was a horrible decision that Arlovsky won. I think a couple of the rounds were really, really razor close. But I thought what happened in that fight is what happens in a lot of Andre Arlovsky fights, something that he's done to a lot better heavyweights than Felipe Lins, which is control distance and control tempo and turn an MMA match into a really slow, lethargic kickboxing match, which is exactly what happened in that fight. But I thought you saw in the first round especially that Felipe Lins' hand speed really gave Andre Arlovsky problems in the first round. And what Arlovsky did at the end of the first round and then in rounds 2 and 3 is he switched to southpaw, which completely took away Arlovsky's ability to throw with power, but also threw Lins off a bit. I don't know, and I guess Arlovsky said after the fight that he was training to do that for quite a while so that he would be comfortable fighting southpaw. Tanner Boser isn't a southpaw. I really don't like the gym he fights at, the shaved Bears MMA in Canada. I think they only have 2 fighters that have ever made it in the UFC. It's not a very proficient gym. I'm not a big fan of Tanner Boser, period. I do think, you know, his grappling may or may not be better. We haven't really seen Felipe Lins as a heavyweight grappling, but I think Lins is actually more diverse. I think his hand speed is going to be much faster than Tanner Boser. You have 2 guys here who aren't one-punch knockout guys. They're more of volume strikers, but at the end of the day, I think Lins is going to throw more volume. I think he hits a little bit harder, and I think whether or not, you know, Boser is better on the ground is debatable, especially considering the gym that Lins trains at. So at basically a pick'em price, I'm going back on Felipe Lins. I'm going to say nothing I saw in the Arlovsky fight really made my handicap of that fight made me feel bad about Lins. I just thought he got sucked into Arlovsky's style of fight and lost a razor close decision that could have gone any way. What's interesting about that fight with Arlovsky, though, is if that razor close decision goes Lins' way, then this fight here is probably 150-160 Lins.
It's a great point.
Because a razor close decision went the other way, now we're a pick'em. I think the value's on the Felipe Lins side.
It's a great point. I mean, look, it's probably going to go the decision. The judge is right. Over under is 2.5 with the over -240. So sizable juice for a total. So you like the volume of Lean. So that makes a lot more sense, all things considered. So yeah, I might follow you on that one. Let's go to the co-main event. Mickey Gall and Mike Perry. Perry, $3 here. It's a welterweight. I guess I understand the price. As Perry obviously wants to keep it standing, you would think he's more of a striker. Has absorbed a lot of punches in recent fights, though. Gall will look to go to the ground. I just think it's a hefty money line here.
I did too at first, especially considering Mike Perry's a guy who has sort of bounced back and forth between lightweight and welterweight. This fight's going to be at welterweight. He fought and beat Paul Felder at lightweight. You know, he has some big wins and losses both at welterweight and lightweight. But look at, I mean, Mike Perry's 6-6 in the UFC, but look at the level of competition. He beat Jake Ellenberger, a perennial top five guy for a long time, beat Paul Felder, beat Cowboy Oliveira, beat Danny Roberts, who's a very good welterweight now, and the losses, Jeff Neal, Cowboy Cerrone, Vicente Luque, Santiago Ponzinibbio, all four of those guys are ranked in the top 10 at welterweight. So, I mean, Mike Perry's fought an extremely high level of competition. On the other side, Mickey Gall may have the four worst wins in the history of UFC. CM Punk, Mike Anderson, who had one win, and it was over CM Punk, Sage Northcutt, and George Sullivan. None of those four are with MMA anymore. Three of them don't even fight anymore. Two of them were never even fighters to begin with. So Mickey Gall, I mean, four of Mickey Gall's six wins are literally against fighters who aren't even really fighters. One of his wins, his initial pro debut, happened on the regional scene. And the only reason he ever came into the UFC, Dana White had no intention of ever signing Mickey Gall, is after his professional debut at a card where Dana White was attending, looking to sign some other people, Mickey Gall said, hey, give me CM Punk. I'm 1-0. CM Punk, you know, is looking for a fight. And Dana said, boy, that makes sense. We can't throw CM Punk in there with an experienced guy. Let's throw him in with this 1-0 kid who ended up getting way too much respect for beating CM Punk, Mike Anderson, and Sage Northcutt. But at the end of the day, when he fought even a respectable fighter in Randy Brown, he was completely outclassed. I think the minus 300 makes sense, but I think rather than laying the 300, I think the better value on this fight is actually under 1.5 rounds plus 105. And to me, one of two things is going to happen really quickly. We've seen Mickey Gall get destroyed on the feet by fighters. His striking game is nowhere near the level it needs to be to even be competitive or even be defensive enough to stay in fights in the UFC. His striking game might be the worst in all of the UFC, literally the worst striking game in the UFC. So there's a good chance that a power puncher like Mike Perry, who 11 of his 13 wins have come via knockout, is going to knock out Mickey Gall within the first couple of minutes of the fight, especially with the smaller cage. That's probably the most likely scenario. The other scenario here is, because of the small cage and we know they're going to engage with each other quickly, is Mickey Gall scores a quick takedown, and while the fighters are still fairly dry, uses that black belt level Brazilian jiu-jitsu and secures a submission and pulls the big upset. I do think he has a path to victory. We always talk with big underdogs, plus 200 or more. What's their path to victory? Well, it's obvious for Mickey Gall. He gets an early takedown, especially early while the fighters aren't real sweaty and slippery, and secures some type of submission because he's not going to last long. You're not going to see Mickey Gall via submission round three. If Mickey Gall, you know, goes 3 minutes into this fight and has to stand for 90 seconds of it, he's going to get knocked out. So really, I think the under on this fight, considering you get plus 105 and considering each guy is so dominant in their area of expertise, Mickey Gall will dominate and probably submit Mike Perry if he gets him on the ground. Mickey Gall is a legit 170-pounder. He's not a guy who fluctuates between 155 and 170. Mickey Gall will never make 155. He's big for 170, standing 6'2", big frame. And if he gets Perry on the ground early, I could see him locking up a submission early. If not, he's probably going to get knocked the bleep out. And I think the fact that you're getting plus 105 or even money on the under, that's probably the way to bet this one.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. And look, it's a way to read between the lines, because as you mentioned, he has a lot of losses, does Perry. He's lost five of his last seven. But the quality of competition, him versus Gall, is just night and day. So I can get behind that. I mean, I'm not opposed to laying $3, too. If it's a one-sided bet, I mean, look, there's a lot of value on tickets in my trash can, right? Like, we sit there and say, oh, it's great value. And then the guy just gets smoked. And you're like, you feel like a sucker, right? Like, you need to hit those eventually. If you're taking plus 200, that's 67%. you got to hit them, right? At one point. So I'm okay laying $3, especially when it's a one-on-one. You feel comfortable. It feels like less fluky. Maybe I'm just talking myself into it, but yeah, no, I like the under 1.5 now that you lay it out in terms of each guy's path to victory. My favorite play is the next one on the card. Pena is also a sizable favorite, -260 against Worthy, but I like the under 2.5. I think Pena is just going to get a quick tap out. It's just that simple. Maybe you can even get Pena inside the number or inside inside the fight in terms of, maybe comboing it or parlaying it, but, Worthy, 13 of the last 15 fights have ended inside the distance there. So I think we're going to get a quick end here. I like under 2.5.
I agree with you, and I was very surprised, actually, Doug, that this total came out 2.5. I understand that the fight's at 155 pounds, so the lighter guys, they almost always use a standard of 2.5 as your round prop total. But I was surprised, because I'm with you. I thought one of two things is likely to happen in this fight. Either Kama Worthy is going to get caught in a submission early because he's extremely reckless, or get knocked out early because he's got knocked out a bunch of times. His chin isn't very good, and his striking defense is atrocious. It's basically non-existent. Or Kama Worthy is going to get a knockout himself early in this fight. I actually took a small flyer at +225 on Kama Worthy, and I bet the under as well like you did. I had to lay -120 on the under. I'm not sure where you got it. I've seen it as good as -110, as high as -130. So I think that under, which is the favorite at most places, it certainly has some fluctuating numbers there. What's interesting about this fight is Luis Pena is the tallest lightweight I think I've ever seen. I don't know for sure that he's the tallest lightweight in history, but he's 6'3",
yeah,
and weighs 155 pounds. Consider this. John Jones is 6'3", and he weighs 205 pounds and has to cut a lot of weight to get down to 205. Imagine a guy the same height as John Jones weighing 155 pounds. To call Luis Pena skinny, to call him thin, to call him rangy, whatever you want, he is the tallest, lankiest, beanpolest fighter I've ever seen. And I wonder with a guy like that, because I remember Cole Miller, who has fought at 145 pounds and was 6 feet tall, and how skinny and lanky he was. And at the end of the day, what Cole Miller didn't do that great was handle big punchers, because you're so thin and he had great submissions himself, much like Luis Pena does. Those long arms and long legs are amazingly effective for submissions. But I also don't think you're as durable, or you handle big strikes as well when your body's that thin. And Kama Worthy can flat out bang. This is a guy who can really bang, has big time power, 9 knockouts in his 15 wins. His last two wins, both coming by way of knockout, including a first-round knockout over Devontae Smith in his last fight. I'm with you. I really like the under, because I'm not sure this one goes long. Kama Worthy's a guy who's faded several times. I could certainly see a scenario where he goes out there throwing bombs, is ineffective, gets taken down once or twice in the first round, gasses and gets submitted in the second, or just gets caught in a submission in the first round as well. But I also think there's a legit chance, more of a chance than these odds are giving credit for, that he lands a big punch on a really skinny guy who may not handle it that well. So I took a little +225 on a flyer while also playing the under 2.5 rounds.
And I mean, look, Pena's gone, he's showed that his frame is maybe not conducive to the conventional wisdom to long fights, but he has proven it. So you want to give him a little credit despite the frame. But, yeah, I'm with you there.
Grapplers. What's interesting is when you look at the guys he's fought, Steve Garcia, grappler, Matt Frivola, who trains at the Sarah Longo gym up in New York, is a big-time grappler. Matt Wyman, another guy who would prefer to grapple. And Matt Wyman's really, that was a comeback fight. He's way past his prime. Steven Peterson, who fights at that Fortis gym, which we're going to talk about in a minute, where none of those guys can strike a lick, it seems like. I mean, yeah, I agree that he has shown durability, and he's never been knocked out, and he's fought in the UFC 6 times. So let's give Pena credit on his durability and his chin. I mean, some people have punched him. This will be the hardest hitter he's ever fought in his career.
And on the next fight on the card, we have a UFC debut, Kyle Daukaus, making his debut after a 9-0 MMA run, 8 submission wins. Like, Brandon Allen's the more balanced fighter here, but he's also laying 270 in this middleweight clash.
Yeah, a little bit steep price here on Brandon Allen, but I think the reason why is he has been so dominant in his short UFC run, and he comes from LFA prior to the UFC. So he had won 3 straight fights in LFA, which is one of the better regional scenes, for getting a fight on Dana White Contender Series where he scored a first-round submission win. And then he fought a really solid Kevin Holland in his UFC debut and gets the rear naked choke there. They step him up in class again against the British fighter Tom Breeze, and he blasted Breeze out with punches and elbows in round one. So Brandon Allen had 3 fights, 3 finishes, trains at a great gym in Rufusport, one of my favorite gyms. And you and I talked about last week how it takes MMA fighters sometimes a little bit longer than boxers to really develop into elite-level fighters because there's so many different crafts that they have to learn. Striking, jiu-jitsu, wrestling, defensive wrestling, kickboxing, everything, Muay Thai. And we both agreed that learning curve isn't as great as it used to be, that guys are training in a more MMA, well-rounded sense growing up now. Well, here's Brandon Allen at just 24 years old, now already with 3 UFC fights under his belt, trains at an amazing gym with Duke Rufus and Anthony and Sergio Pettis up there in Milwaukee. This is a really impressive young man, not somebody that I want to get in front of it all. And obviously, if you're looking for an underdog play here, because, you know, Allen's a pretty significant favorite as well, creeping up around minus 300 now. You know, what's the path to victory for Kyle Daukaus? Maybe it's a submission win, but so far the grappling of Brandon Allen's been really good. And I don't see a scenario where the newcomer is going to come in and suddenly out-grapple Brandon Allen. And I think it's safe to say Allen's going to have significant advantages on the feet here. I noticed that this one was only 1.5 rounds. I thought about maybe is there value on the under plus 125, possibly. But at the end of the day, I stayed away because I didn't want to lay the price. But just like you talked about laying 300 with Mike Perry, because maybe it's just such a mismatch. I mean, let's face it, Mickey Gall is the easiest fighter Mike Perry has ever fought in the UFC. Kyle Daukaus might be the easiest opponent for Brendan Allen in quite some time. And if it's minus 280 or if it goes down to I don't know, there could be a number here where I get on Brendan Allen because I just think he's that good. I have so much respect for the gym he trains at. I normally try to stay away from 24-year-olds, but he's proved it already 3 times in the UFC, twice against guys that I would probably consider tougher than Daukaus.
What do you make of an inside the distance bet on this one?
Maybe that's what I like better than the 1.5, because my fear here is that it turns into a bit of a grappling match early, that Daukaus is able to get some takedowns early. Allen's really good in the scrambles, but that their submission games and submission defense kind of negate each other. And then what normally happens in those grappler matchups is they get tired of that. That's so exhausting trying to go for and defend submissions that by round 2, now you have 2 tired guys, and now it's harder to get takedowns. And on the feet, Brendan Allen chops him up. But maybe we get a late second round stoppage or an early third round stoppage. So I think you're right. I think Allen inside the distance is probably the best play.
Somebody I work with said that was a lock. I mean, you know, you throw around those terms lock, but he really liked that. So I wanted to at least pass that along, and as well as the Gall fight. You know, he thought inside the distance was the right way to play that one. And, I could get behind that. I mean, I know you like the under there. So inside the distance, you're going to have to pay a little extra juice, but you got that protection rather than just the half round and those under 2.5. So wanted to at least pass that around. Our first women's fight, this one coming in the flyweight division. Difference in age here, a 34-year-old versus a 22-year-old with Miranda Maverick facing Barrero here.
Yeah, and this is an interesting fight. Miranda Maverick, I mean, she's suddenly becoming kind of the sweetheart of this card, getting a lot of respect, a huge respect at the betting windows. And I immediately said, let me find a way to get on the dog here. And first of all, I understand that it's her UFC debut, Miranda Maverick. But every single fight that she's had is an Invicta. And Invicta, in women's MMA, Invicta is equivalent to Bellator in men's MMA. So I want people to understand how important those Invicta fights are. It's the equivalent in women's MMA of fighting in Bellator and men's MMA, which means it's just one notch down from the UFC, basically. So the fact that she has 9 fights in Invicta means she's been fighting a very serious level of competition for a 22-year-old. So that's impressive right there. I mean, so I looked at Borrello and I said, okay, how's she going to win this fight? I mean, she does have wins in the UFC before. She has 2 UFC wins. She's 2-4. She's fought in some really good ladies. Courtney Casey, we know, is solid. Caitlin Chookajian, who we were on about a month back, is really solid. I mean, Chookajian fought for a title. So the level of competition is certainly there. I just wonder what her path to victory is here. She's not a huge puncher. She's not a great submission expert, although she has 4 submission wins. I don't think she's going to be able to wrestle with Miranda Maverick, who is just a devastating wrestler, so athletic and so strong. So, but again, she's 22, she's inexperienced, and where she's really lacks, I think, is in the striking department. I think when the wrestling doesn't go right for Miranda Maverick, you know, then there could be some potential issues on the feet. I just didn't know if Borrello could take advantage of those, and I just stayed away. The price was a little high. I couldn't make a case for the dog. I couldn't really make a case for the total. So this one's going to be a stay away for me as well.
So when you're looking at it, it's minus 300, you're saying it's the same price as Perry, but you think Perry's just such a better bet, and so there's value there, but not here with Maverick.
Correct. I think, look, it's basically the same odds as Perry or Allen, but when you look at Perry or Allen, the advantages that the favorite has in those fights are so much more significant than in this fight. Especially, I never like laying a huge price with a fighter who's really one-dimensional. And in the case of Miranda Maverick, her game is really based around her wrestling and then ability to get submissions or control the fight through that wrestling. And look, we've seen it before. When wrestlers can't get takedowns and they don't have a plan B, it usually goes very poorly. And as a 22-year-old still trying to learn the different aspects of striking and MMA, there's certainly a scenario here where against a very experienced veteran, that wrestling doesn't work. You know, Borrello stuffs some takedowns, and now they're on the feet, and Miranda Maverick, you know, doesn't have the striking to hang and loses. So I'm much less confident in the favorite here than I am the other ones. But I also don't love Borrello. It's hard for me to envision her really putting together a big performance here. I think if she was going to, it's all predicated on stuffing the takedowns in round 1 and getting the striking game going in round 2 and 3.
All right. So you like Borrello maybe to hang in there and mix things up enough to keep you off Maverick. Next fight you really like, and I'll let you go first with Sato.
Yeah, Sato is my angle of the week. You know, we had one last week with Raquel Pennington with her level of competition and then the massive age difference, a 43-year-old fighter versus a 31-year-old fighter right in their prime. And this fight caught my eye Monday because I always like to see what is the early kind of sharp action on, because, you know, I think you and I are probably sharp UFC bettors, Doug. And of course, we disagree sometimes, and I disagree with the sharp sometimes as well. And this was a line where Sato opened a much bigger favorite, and we saw a lot of love for the underdog, and it dropped all the way down to Sato minus 130. So I really started looking into why did the line drop so much? Because a lot of times it doesn't take a lot of money early in the week to drop a line. It's just, hey, sometimes it's one respected guy bet a couple of dimes on the underdog, and the books massively move that number much more aggressively than they would if that same bet came in on a Friday night or a Saturday afternoon, because they're worried that, you know, the rest of the sharp action may follow, and they don't want to have an underdog out there at this massive vulnerability. But I completely disagree. I love Sato in this fight. And one of the things I like about, first of all, he has big time UFC experience. You know, he's been in a couple UFC fights already where, Brahimaj is making his UFC debut. He knocked out a really gritty veteran in Ben Saunders, a guy who's powerful himself, has been in there with some of the best in the world. Sato knocked him out. His last loss against Belial Muhammad, well, Belial Muhammad looked pretty good in a win this past weekend, so that one loss he has in the UFC has aged pretty well against the guy who is probably going to be in the top 15 or just outside of it. So you can excuse that one loss he has in the UFC. He has 10 knockout wins and 10 knockouts and 15 career wins. And we know in the smaller cage, it favors knockout punchers and elite wrestlers. And on the other side, I found an angle that I really like is the Fortis MMA guys. And we talk about gyms a lot on this show. This gym is hot. This gym striking coach is amazing right now. Whoever the striking coaches are at Fortis Gym, because I have to imagine they keep changing them, they might be doing the worst job in all of MMA. Here are the guys that are in UFC or who have recently left UFC who train at Fortis Gym in their last fight. So Charles Byrd, who we just saw fight 2 weeks ago, knocked out in his last fight. Alex Morono, one of the best wrestlers at 135 or 125 pounds, knocked out in his last fight. Austin Lingo lost his UFC debut and was in a fight that he got dominated in the striking. Damon Jackson lost his last fight by knockout. Miles Johns, who was undefeated, 10-0 to start his career, went to Fortis MMA, got knocked out in his last fight. Now he's 10-1. Rashard Coulter, knocked out in his last fight. Ryan Spann, won his last fight actually by split decision, but he was like a minus 500 favorite against Sam Alvey and had to go to split decision and almost got knocked out in the third round by Alvey in a fight where it could have been a draw. You could have given Alvey a 10-8 in the third because he knocked him down twice and just about KO'd Spann. And Steven Peterson, again, another guy who got outstruck in two of his last three fights that's an elite grappler. So this gym, the Fortis MMA gym, is known for having some of the best grapplers in the world. So, all right, what's the path to victory for Brahimaj? Obviously, he's got to get the fight to the ground and get a submission. But this is a guy who only went 2-2 in his last four fights in LFA. So on a regional scene, he was 2-2. And now people are expecting that he's going to come in and his UFC debut and finish a power puncher like Sato, especially coming out of a gym where none of those guys can strike. I don't know what's happening. I don't know if it's the striking defense, but we just listed everyone in the UFC from that gym, and they all got knocked out basically in their last fight. Something's going wrong with the striking at the Fortis MMA gym, and that doesn't bode well when you're facing a power puncher like Sato here. I laid Sato big at minus 130, and it's my favorite play of the week.
Okay, so I actually talked to a bookmaker, and their sharpest guy in any sport is a UFC bettor, and he makes like one or two bets, sometimes early in the week, sometimes like right at post. And his play this week was opposite you. So Brahimaj, that's why the market moved.
And I knew that a couple of super sharp guys, and I talk to, you know, a lot of the sportsbook operators are our clients, and I see the bets come in. We get betting data from those operators. And I knew that there were a couple of sharp bets that came in early on the other side. And I tried my best to make the case for that side. I looked into this fight really extensively to the point where I did a lot of research on the Fortis MMA gym. I tried to find the reason why.
Yeah.
I respect the fact that some of these guys are really sharp, but I'll tell you this. I end up on the other side of some of these guys sometimes too, and then I do just fine at MMA. So I respect their opinions, but I lean the other way here. And I think at minus 130, the value's on Sato. I'll admit too, I've been hesitant in the past to bet Pancrase fighters. And way back in the day, the problem with Pancrase fighters used to be that Pancrase wouldn't let you strike with fist. It was open-handed striking way back in the day, like Ken Shamrock before he went into UFC 1 and those early UFCs with Hoyce Gracie and everyone was in Pancrase. And Pancrase would do open-palm striking, and thus a lot of times the guys coming from Pancrase would have trouble dealing with the punches coming in from UFC fighters. But that's not the case anymore. Basically, Pancrase is just an elite-level Asian MMA organization. They have all the same rules essentially as UFC would now. And we see guys have a lot of success from Pacific Islands or Asia and coming over now having success in the UFC from Pancrase. And he proved it in his UFC debut by actually dusting a really good veteran in Ben Saunders and then having a fairly competitive fight with a guy, Belal Muhammad, who's in the top 15. I just don't know who Brahimov has beat. And 2-2 in LFA doesn't get me excited. I respect the fact that there's some really smart people on him, but I love Sato this week.
Yeah, no, look, he's that flawless, this, and he picks a lot of dogs, so you don't have to even go be 500 to make money, right? And I know the last pick was not successful, but I thought it was funny because that was your favorite card, and I loved your analysis. It's enough for me to be off it, right, both sides. And I might even back you with Sato because I do agree with the analysis, but I wanted to at least share that with you. Couple more fights to get through before we wrap things up. Zalal versus Native Psycho Griffin. This is basically a pick 'em. This is an interesting fight at featherweight. I think both guys are poised to kind of make a run and make some noise and ascend through the ranks, but I just can't pick which one.
Right, and you know what's funny about this fight is, so again, Monday I was going through a few fights, trying to bet the early numbers. You know, one of the things I enjoy doing, and for people that like to bet MMA, and again, assuming that you're not trying to bet MMA or bet anything for a living, that you're just betting it for fun and trying to make a little money, one of the most fun things to do is make bets on Monday or Tuesday and then see how many times those bets you make are Monday, Tuesday, you got the best odds on it. And that's kind of indicative of how your handicapping is going. If you get the best odds 60% of the time, regardless of your winning or losing, you know, at least you're getting good numbers. And I'm not saying that everyone should make bets on Monday, but there is some value and fun in it. So I go through the fights on Monday, always making a few bets, just to see, because I think maybe the numbers are good. So I looked at this fight, and on Monday, I ended up on Zalal. I said, man, I love his pedigree. I love the gym. Even though he's a 23-year-old, I love the fact that he trains at Factory X, which is one of the biggest gyms in MMA. I think they have 31 fighters that are in the UFC or Bellator right now. Just so many guys right now from Factory X to train with, elite-level training. He's 5'10". Which is really tall for 145, but he doesn't look thin or dehydrated. You know, he doesn't look Luis Pena thin at 5'10", 145. And he has amazing submission defense. And I thought, look, at the end of the day, if Jordan Griffin's probably going to dominate this fight, he probably needs to win by submission. And then I made the mistake, or maybe not mistake, but I went back and watched the Jordan Griffin loss to Dan Ige again. And if, you know, for anyone who doesn't remember how Dan Ige, how good he is, he's the guy who recently had that controversial split decision win over Edson Barbosa and who's going to main event a card here coming up against Calvin Kattar. I mean, Dan Ige's really good. Whether or not he really beat Edson Barbosa is a different story, but he's a really good young fighter. And I just couldn't help but, you know, think that, man, Jordan Griffin was really competitive in that Dan Ige fight. He stood in the pocket. He traded punches with a guy who's a really has huge hand speed, a technical striker. We saw it against Edson Barbosa, how fast the hand speed of Dan Ige is. And Griffin hung in there in that fight and made it a really competitive fight. And you can't ignore the experience of fighting elite level competition like that compared to the 23-year-old. Well, I love this. Both these guys, you could make a case for either guy, and somehow I don't have any bets on this fight, and yet I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, no, I'm excited too. Should be a good one. No, I'm not firing on this one. Last one, another women's fight, Frey and Hansen. Hansen about $165. This is kind of a late addition because of a canceled bout. Second youngest fighter in the UFC, which is kind of interesting with Hansen, and she's a sizable favorite.
Yeah, and this one, I'm very much leaning toward Frey. And I don't have a bet yet on Frey, but I almost assuredly will. And again, we talked about Invicta kind of being the Bellator of MMA in the women's world. And if I'm not mistaken, Frey was the reigning 110-pound champion in Invicta. So, I mean, she's fought some elite people. She went over and fought in Rizin. I like her experience here. I do agree that at 35, she's probably slowing down. Probably never had a great peak. She was always more of a grinder than elite level striker or submission wrestler. But she's pretty tough. And I know what I'm getting with Frey. Even at 35, I don't think she's slowed down that much yet. Where with Hansen, man, I don't like betting fighters under 23, period, especially in a favorite role. And I don't know what about her resume. I understand the fact that she's going to be taller, bigger, stronger. She'll have height advantages in this. She'll have reach advantages in the fight. She also has fought every single one of her fights in Invicta. So the level of competition's pretty high there for her as well. I actually think Frey's live. I think 20-year-olds. Yeah, we've seen a lot of 20-year-olds in MMA. We just saw a big favorite a couple of weeks ago fail, right? A 20-year-old in MMA. I think this could be another one of those situations that I think that if you're going to play it, you probably need to take the plus money, because at this point you're going to get plus 155-ish, Frey. And the fight feels a lot closer to a pick'em than it does one of these ladies having a 65 to 67% chance of winning.
Yeah, I believe that was Hooper in the men's side, and he obviously pressed a lot in a lot of ways. The fight went the distance and showed a tough chin. But, yeah, I mean, the inexperience showed. The broadcast team talked about it. So, all right, my man, great stuff as always. I appreciate the insight. We'll see how that Sato fight plays out, but appreciate your insight as always.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Always a pleasure, my friend. Best of luck this weekend. Take care.
And I want to tell you and remind you that golf is back. That's right. We have a full weekend of golf ahead of us. And even though the trophy is reserved for the winner, the big cash prizes don't have to be. To add to the excitement, DraftKings, the leader in daily fantasy sports, is putting you in the center of the action with a free shot at $1 million in prizes with your first deposit. It's easy to play. Just pick six golfers, stay under the salary cap, and submit your lineup before the tournament tees off on Thursday. Then sit back and follow all the action. The more red numbers they have on the leaderboard, the closer you'll be to winning some green. Rack up points for pars, birdies, finishing position, and more. And in a time of limited sports, this is your chance to scratch your competitive itch and reign supreme. Download the DraftKings app now. Use code Doug during signup. This week, DraftKings is putting you in the action with a free shot at millions of dollars in prizes. That's code Doug, D-O-U-G, and you can get a free shot at millions of dollars in prizes only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. And just a reminder, DraftKings is giving new users a free shot at over $100,000. Download the DraftKings app and enter code Doug at sign up. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Time now to talk a little golf. And to do that, we're going to bring in a man who's making his debut here on the Behind the Bets, Wes Reynolds from Las Vegas. You hear him a little bit on VSiN, a golf guru, handicapper. Wes, thank you for taking the time, my man.
Doug, thanks for having me on, man. Glad to make my debut here on the pod.
Well, that's awesome. And also, you know, obviously, we want to break this down. It's in my backyard, but, you know, there's so much more interest with golf right now. So I wanted to get sort of added to the pod and try to get this done on Wednesdays. Hopefully people can pick, get some insight on your part and go from there. But, so let's talk. What are your favorite outrights for this Travelers Championship, which is a short course, kind of like the last 2 weeks, right? Like more target golf, irons, I should say, are, certainly have more of a premium, but that doesn't mean the driving doesn't matter for this course as opposed to the previous one. So kind of what's your overall assessment and approach to this weekend with some outrights that caught your eye?
Yeah, my leadoff picks were actually both of the Bash brothers of golf, that the Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson, but one of the Bash brothers, as we record, has apparently withdrawn for the tournament, that being Brooks Koepka, apparently a positive COVID test for his caddy. So he is, as of now, withdrawn from the tournament. And it looks like we're still going to have golf, as we discuss here. Brian Wacker from Golf Digest reporting that the PGA Tour Commissioner, Jay Monahan, is going to have a presser. And it looks like all systems are still going to be a go for this event as we record here. But with Koepka out, Obviously, I still like the position of Dustin Johnson. And on the surface, he wouldn't look to fit this course because this is a shorter course. This is the second shortest course on the PGA Tour this week at TPC River Highlands, the first being Pebble Beach, where Dustin Johnson's had quite a bit of success, having won there a couple times and also two runner-ups in the Pro-Am. So I really like what I saw last week out of DJ. It was a relatively quiet T17 at the RBC, and he hasn't played here since 2014, but I liked how he hit it off the tee, the second strokes gained off the tee behind Brooks Koepka, and was ninth in strokes gained tee to green. And he spoke of having some confidence back in the game. Both guys work with Claude Harmon III, who's, of course, the son of Butch Harmon. And, look, they have very similar games. Dustin Johnson has succeeded a lot on some Pete Dye courses, which he's going to see this week up at River Highlands. And also I liked his West Coast play because this week they're going to be putting on a bent grass Poa-Anwa mix on the greens. And you usually see a lot of those greens in the West Coast tournaments in February, AT&T Pebble Beach, at Riviera, at Torrey Pines. So DJ's always been a guy that's played well there. I mentioned his wins at Pebble Beach. He's also won at Riviera, which is going to be probably the closest facsimile to the greens he's going to see this week. And you look at his career, DJ has 20 PGA Tour career wins. 10 of them are on bent grass or Poa. So he likes these greens a lot better than the Bermuda he saw last week down in South Carolina. So DJ was a guy I liked. A couple of former winner I liked this week as well, Mark Leishman, who you can now get as maybe as high as 70-1. He's already won on a similar course this year. He won at Torrey Pines earlier this year, so he's got an excellent record out west. So I liked him. And then a couple longer shots that I did play. I did play Sergio Garcia just because his ball striking was so good last week. He was dead last in the field in strokes gained putting after the first round, and still probably could have won the tournament if he just made a few putts. He missed, I think, 5 putts inside of 5 feet. If he makes those, obviously he wins, but there's a lot of ifs for other players that you can say as well, like Abraham Answer, who hit 18 greens last week on Sunday, 65-72, and still lost by 1 to Webb Simpson. But there's a couple value guys down the board, like a Garcia, like a Joel Damon, who was tied just one shot out of the lead going into Sunday last week, had a bad round on the final round. And I think it was a misleading finish. It was T48, but I thought he played a lot better and struck the ball a lot better. So those were guys I was looking at on the outright.
Okay, so I agree with Sergio. I thought 40-1 at Caesars. I just couldn't pull the trigger. Leishman's 50-1. I'm talking about the picks I had to submit for ESPN.com. Damon right there at 80-1. That was like my final cut, if you will, on my card. So that means to anyone listening, he's definitely going to win because he was my final cut. So I would definitely fire on Damon in terms of the guys I did not play. The ones I did in terms of the realistic one was Shoffley at 28-1. As you mentioned, the second shortest course. He always does well on these types of courses. Missed the cut last week, but I'm hoping it was sort of like how the first week ended. Like, you know, obviously that lipped putt, maybe just kind of, you know, still lingering and kind of threw off his game. So I'm going to still stick with my guy, so to speak, with Shoffley at 28-1. He putts well on Poa. So that's enough for me to bite. How about a couple bombers in terms of the long shot odds? Max Homa, 125-1. He gained 3 strokes off the tee last week, 6.2 on approach shots. He's gained tee to green in 7 straight starts. He's historically better on Poa. I think he's going to cash one of these days, so I kind of want to be on him at 125. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm on him actually this week. That was my longest shot that I played. He was playing really good golf before, obviously, the pause in play. Had 4 top tens in a 3-month span from December to February. Was 41st last week at the RBC, and that's certainly not going to raise a lot of eyebrows when you're looking into recent form, but all 4 rounds in the 60s, was 5th in strokes gained approach last week. Really where he kind of struggled was around the greens, and I think he'll like the greens better this week, and it's very evident by how he played on the West Coast earlier this year. He was tied for ninth at Torrey Pines, tied for 14th at Pebble Beach, and tied for fifth at Riviera. So he's a California guy that I think clearly likes the bent POA mix a lot better than he does the Bermuda.
Good. So like that you're back. I mean, he is not the longest shot I have. I'll tell you who is Siwoo Kim at 350-1. Look, he's been a Pete Dye specialist. That includes cashing as a 500-1 long shot at the Players. He finished second at the Heritage 2 years ago. He's played well in three starts at this particular course. And he kind of has a knack for coming out of nowhere, which makes no sense because that means you're not playing in good form. But he's missed eight of his last nine. When he did that, he still managed to kind of sit tied for second at the Players before the shutdown with the pandemic. So, I just think 350-1 is enough for me to throw a very, very small wager, but probably have some fun in top 20, top 40 payouts.
Yeah, what you said about Siwoo is absolutely true. You never know when this guy is going to show up. And when he shows up, he shows up big. I mean, the fact that, he has won the Players Championship. He won the Wyndham back in 2016. This is a guy that all of a sudden, he's not really what you call a form player in terms of the fact that, you know, he just knocks down a bunch of made cuts and cashes a bunch of checks. He is the ultimate boom or bust guy really on the PGA Tour. But when he hits, and he's almost kind of a favorite of social media golf Twitter, you know, because a lot of guys play him in long shots and sometimes he's going to miss the cut really badly, and then sometimes he's going to give you a big boom with at a big price. So I never necessarily argue with it. It's just kind of anticipating when the good performance is coming.
Right. And at 350-1, you don't have to, like, risk a lot, right? Like, you can just kind of get involved with a very small. But you have the top 20, top 40 payout. So that covers our outrights. Obviously, there's so many more guys in this, right? Like, you know, there's people that were on my edit room floor, if you will. So, look, I've been suckered into Rory the last couple weeks. I just couldn't do it. Cantley, we know what he did when he was at college. He shot a 60 on one round in 2011. So I just haven't jumped on him. I think it's like a trendy pick. I think Hovland is a guy I was on last week. He's kind of an auto bet when it's 60-1 for me. Even Scheffler at 75. Neiman, it was in my, and then Leishman, actually, I had circled as well. So those are guys that caught my eye. Just, you know, I didn't want to play everyone just yet.
Yeah, Neiman, you mentioned. Neiman's kind of been a little bit of a buzz player this week and is getting his price shorted really across the board because of how well he played last week. He's a guy that's getting play. Abe Anser's getting a lot of play. Now, with Anser, I'm really high on him. He's in the top 25, and he's a really good player that hasn't gotten that first PGA Tour win yet. But I wonder the psychology of an Abraham Anser, because when you go out and you shoot 65 on a Sunday and you hit 18 of 18 green, you go 65 of 72 throughout the week, 21 under through four rounds, and you lose. How do you recover from that in just a few days? It's like, I played probably the best golf of anybody on the course on Sunday, and I got nipped at the end by Webb Simpson. So that's what skirted me away from him. One guy I may throw in here, and you're starting to see some of the prices on the favorites shorten a little bit, Rory, Bryson, Justin Thomas with the Koepka withdrawal. One guy I might make a case for a little bit is Sungjae Im, who – he's been on the tour just a couple years. He's obviously a guy that likes to play. He's kind of the modern day Vijay Singh, and is that he never likes to take weeks off. He likes to play 35 events a year. And I think maybe the stoppage in play probably played a little bit with his mind because he didn't know what to do because he didn't have events to play. He pretty much lives on the road and doesn't have a permanent home. But if you look at his numbers, his worst two strokes game putting performances in his short career on the PGA Tour, both at the RBC Heritage. He lost 4.4 strokes game putting last week and 3.74 the year before in 2019 at the same course in Harbortown. You could make a case that, hey, maybe he just doesn't like that course or just doesn't like those greens. He's getting on the bent this week. I think he'll like it better. So maybe that's a guy you want to look at, even though he missed the cut. Not all missed cuts are equal, as we saw with Webb Simpson. last week, where he missed the cut at Colonial the week before. And then last week was brilliant with his putter in the second round, and then lost it on Saturday, and then got it back on the back nine on Sunday to shoot a 30 and win. But Sung Jae-im is one I would maybe, I'm starting to kind of like, as we're seeing a couple of withdrawals from the event.
Interesting. Okay. And like you mentioned, there is always a domino effect, like you mentioned with Koepka going out, so some of the other guys, which makes sense. All right, in terms of matchups, do you have any that caught your eye?
Well, one that I was going to play, even though I played them both on the feature, I did play DJ over Koepka. That apparently is now going to be canceled. But
correct.
One that I did use Rahm at a small plus price against Rory. And it's not necessarily that I think Rory is playing bad. When I think everybody's at their best, I still think Rory is always the guy to beat. I still
Correct.
Think he's the number one guy in the world when everybody is at their best, because we've seen too many dominant performances from Rory in big time tournaments and majors. When he's on, he's still the man to beat. But I took Rahm this week in a matchup against him, and it's about plus 105, plus 110, somewhere in that range. Just because, look, John Rahm did not play well at Colonial. Really was just kind of okay at the RBC last week. Layoffs are different for different players, and some guys come out pistons firing, like Justin Thomas has, like Bryson DeChambeau has, with two top tens in back-to-back weeks with the return of the tour. Rahm has really not, but usually he doesn't stay down for long. If he has a couple performances outside the top 10, he's usually right up there in that top five the following week. This is not a guy that usually, if he has struggles by his standards, has prolonged struggles. He usually rectifies it pretty quickly. So he's a guy that I played on matchups as well. Just a couple more that I'm kind of looking at right here. Corey Connors, who I thought played very well last week. I think he's matched up with Scottie Scheffler. Corey Connors is actually seeing the money. And we know the story with Corey Connors if you're a regular follower of the tour. His ball striking numbers are always off the charts good. His putting is not always the same. Yeah, he was okay with it last week. He started off hot and then kind of cooled off over the weekend. But this is a guy whose ball striking is just so amazing. Last year, he won at the Valero Texas Open down in San Antonio. He was a Monday qualifier and got into the field that way and ended up winning the whole tournament. So he's a guy with a lot of talent. When you look at those stats every week, strokes gained approach, greens in regulation, he's always there kind of in the top 10 or top 15. So that's one I was looking at. But these matchups for me have been a little bit tougher just because we have so much quality in the field right away.
Yeah.
I knew the guys were going to be chomping at the bit to get back out on the course and get back at least to some sort of normalcy in terms of a playing schedule. But I didn't think the fields would be this stacked. I mean, when do we ever see in your backyard? I mean, usually the Travelers has a good field. It's well attended. It's well supported. The volunteers are great during what is a normal year. But you don't usually get 34 of the top 40 players in the official world golf rankings to play the Travelers Championship in Hartford. So the field quality has just been so good right away that it's kind of thrown me off, because we're not getting the normal fields and we're not getting the tournaments, say for this week, played in their normal spots in the schedule.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. They're so good. So much of this play. I mean, you just mentioned what some of these guys like Answer and others have done on Sunday, and it's just so hard. I mean, it makes a great theater on television. And I think there was a prop at some book I heard on some network. I forget where it was, but it was basically you could make a prop bet. Will the winner come from the leading group, you know, the lead group on Sunday? And it was plus money. No, and it's gone down each week because it's not someone who started with the lead or tied for the lead on Sunday. And there's just all such a bottleneck at the top. It's really been made for just great golf.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, you mentioned that since I think 2012 was the last time at last week's event, the RBC Heritage, where you had a 54-hole leader hold the lead, and that was Carl Pettersson. Webb Simpson was tied for the lead last week with Tyrrell Hatton and with Abe Ancer. and he was actually able to hold the lead, because usually that RBC tournament is something somewhere where a guy comes back from three or four on Sunday, and the guy that just shoots the low round at the right time is the one that wins.
Interesting. And to your point, so the reports are surfacing that there's been multiple positive tests for COVID on the PGA Tour. So, but all signs pointing to the tournament still proceeding as expected. Obviously, when we tape the podcast, it's not always the last minute, but hopefully all this dialogue we had here will work out well here for the rest of the weekend in terms of golf. Wes, I appreciate the insight as always, man. Good catching up. And hopefully one of these guys can hoist a trophy on Sunday.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for having me on, pal. Really appreciate the time.
GEICO knows there are many reasons why you ride. From the thrill of the revving engine and pure adrenaline of flying down the highway to the confidence of knowing that GEICO always has your back with 24/7 access to claim service. But Ari Snyder has one reason in particular.
I have extremely large upper arms. They won't even fit into most shirts. Thankfully, biking really embraces vest culture, so I feel accepted.
GEICO Motorcycle. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.